This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Frankenstein in Baghdad by Ahmed Sadawi. Read for you by Eduardo Ballerini and Kaleo Griffith.
Top Secret. Final Report. 1. With regard to the activities of the Tracking and Pursuit Department, which is partially affiliated with the civil administration of the International Coalition Forces in Iraq, a special committee of inquiry set up under my chairmanship with representatives of the Iraqi security and intelligence agencies and observers from U.S. military intelligence has come to the following conclusions. A. On September 25, 2005, under direct political pressure from the Iraqi side, the activities of the Tracking and Pursuit Department were partially suspended for the purposes of the inquiry, and the committee summoned the department director, Brigadier Sarur Mohammed Majid, and his assistants to testify. They briefed the committee on the nature of the work they had been engaged in since the formation of the Coalition Provisional Authority in April 2003, and up to the time of the inquiry. It is clear that the department had been operating outside its area of expertise, which should have been limited to such bureaucratic matters as archiving information and preserving files and documents. Under the direct management of Brigadier Majid, it had employed several astrologers and fortune tellers on high salaries financed by the Iraqi treasury, not by the U.S. authorities. According to Brigadier Majid's testimony, their only purpose was to make predictions about serious security incidents that might take place in Baghdad and surrounding areas. It is not clear to the committee to what extent these predictions helped avert security incidents or whether they had any practical benefits. B. The committee established that a number of files preserved in the department had been leaked from inside. All those working in the department were subsequently detained for questioning. C. Through an examination of the computers used in the department, it was discovered that documents had been sent by email to someone referred to as the author. Upon further investigation, this person was identified and arrested at his place of residence in the Fanar Hotel on Abu Nawas Street. No documents related to the Tracking and Pursuit Department were found in his possession. The author was found to be in possession of the text of a story he had written, drawing on material contained in documents belonging to the Tracking and Pursuit Department. D. The story is about 250 pages long, divided into 17 chapters. Experts from the committee examined the text and concluded that it does not violate any provisions of the law, but for precautionary reasons they recommended that the information in it should not be published under any circumstances, and that the story should not be rewritten. 2. Recommendations. A. The committee recommends that Brigadier Sarur Mohammed Majid and his assistants be transferred from the Tracking and Pursuit Department and that the department revert to its original work of archiving and documentation. Those employed as astrologers and fortune tellers should be laid off. The question of the mistakes the department has made over the past few years must remain under review, and the documents relevant to the department's activities must be preserved. B. The committee discovered that the personal information in the identity papers of the author is incorrect. It therefore recommends that the author be rearrested and questioned in order to learn his real identity and any other information relevant to the work of the Tracking and Pursuit Department, and also to identify the people in the department who cooperated with him and to assess the extent to which this matter poses a threat to national security. Signed, Committee Chairman.
Chapter 1. The Madwoman. 1. The explosion took place 2 minutes after Elishva, the old woman known as Daniel, or Daniel's mother, boarded the bus. Everyone on the bus turned around to see what had happened. They watched in shock as a ball of smoke rose, dark and black, beyond the crowds, from the car park near Tehran Square in the center of Baghdad. Young people raced to the scene of the explosion, and cars collided into each other or into the median. The drivers were frightened and confused. They were assaulted by the sound of car horns and of people screaming and shouting. Elishva's neighbors in Lane 7 said later that she had left the Batawin district to pray in the Church of St. Odisho, near the University of Technology, as she did every Sunday, and that's why the explosion happened. Many of the locals believed that with her spiritual powers, Elishva prevented bad things from happening when she was among them. Sitting on the bus, minding her own business, as if she were deaf and not even there, Elishva didn't hear the massive explosion about 200 yards behind her. Her frail body was curled up by the window, and she looked out without seeing anything, thinking about the bitter taste in her mouth and the sense of gloom that she had been unable to shake off for the past few days. The bitter taste might disappear after she took Holy Communion. Hearing the voices of her daughters and their children on the phone, she would have a little respite from her melancholy, and the light would shine again in her cloudy eyes. Father Josiah would usually wait for his cell phone to ring, and then tell Elishva that Matilda was on the line, or if Matilda didn't call on time, Elishva might wait another hour and then ask the priest to call Matilda. This had been repeated every Sunday for at least 2 years. Before that, Elishva's daughters had called irregularly on the landline at church. But then when the Americans invaded Baghdad, their missiles destroyed the telephone exchange, and the phones were cut off for many months. Death stalked the city like the plague, and Elishva's daughters felt the need to check every week that the old woman was okay. At first, after a few difficult months, they spoke on the Turaya satellite phone that a Japanese charity had given to the young Assyrian priest at the church. When the wireless networks were introduced, Father Josiah bought a cell phone, and Elishva spoke to her daughters on that. Members of the congregation would stand in line after Mass to hear the voices of their sons and daughters dispersed around the world, often people from the surrounding Karaj Alamana neighborhood, Christians of other denominations and Muslims too, would come to the church to make free calls to their relatives abroad. As cell phones spread, the demand for Father Josiah's phone declined. But Elishva was content to maintain the ritual of her Sunday phone call from church. With her veined and wrinkled hand, Elishva would put the Nokia phone to her ear. Upon hearing her daughter's voices, the darkness would lift, and she would feel at peace. If she had gone straight back to Tehran Square, she would have found that everything was calm, just as she had left it in the morning. The sidewalks would be clean, and the cars that had caught fire would have been towed away. The dead would have been taken to the forensics department, and the injured to the Kindy Hospital. There would be some shattered glass here and there, a pole blackened with smoke, and a hole in the asphalt, though she wouldn't have been able to make out how big it was because of her blurred vision. When the Mass was over, she lingered for an extra hour. She sat down in the hall adjacent to the church, and after the women had set out on tables the food they brought with them, she went ahead and ate with everyone, just to have something to do. Father Josiah made a desperate last attempt to call Matilda, but her phone was out of service. Matilda had probably lost her phone, or it had been stolen from her on the street or at some market in Melbourne where she lived. Maybe she'd forgotten to write down Father Josiah's number, or had some other excuse. The priest couldn't make sense of it, but kept trying to console Elishva. And when everyone started leaving, the deacon, Nader Shamuni, offered Elishva a ride home in his old Volga. This was the second week without a phone call. Elishva didn't actually need to hear her daughter's voices. Maybe it was just habit or something more important. But with her daughters, she could talk about Daniel. Nobody really listened to her when she spoke about the son she had lost 20 years ago, except for her daughters and St. George the Martyr, whose soul she often prayed for, and whom she saw as her patron saint. You might add her old cat, Nabu, whose hair was falling out and who slept most of the time. Even the women at church grew distant when she began to talk about her son, because she just said the same things over and over. It was the same with the old women who were her neighbors. Some of them couldn't remember what Daniel looked like. Besides, he was just one of many who died over the years. Elishva was gradually losing people who had once supported her strange conviction that her son was still alive, even though he had a grave with an empty coffin in the cemetery of the Assyrian Church of the East. Elishva no longer shared with anyone her belief that Daniel was still alive. She just waited to hear the voice of Matilda or Hilda, because they would put up with her, however strange this idea of hers. The two daughters knew their mother clung to the memory of her late son in order to go on living. There was no harm in humoring her. Nader Shamuni, the deacon, dropped off Elishva in Lane 7 in Batawin, just a few steps from her door. The street was quiet. The slaughter had ended several hours ago, but the destruction was still clearly visible. It might have been the neighborhood's biggest explosion. The old deacon was depressed. He didn't say a word to Elishva as he parked his car next to an electricity pole. There was blood and hair on the pole, mere inches from his nose and his thick white mustache. He felt a tremor of fear. Elishva got out of the deacon's car and waved goodbye. Walking down the street, she could hear her unhurried footsteps on the gravel. She was preparing an answer for when she opened the door and Nabu looked up as if to ask, "So? What happened?" More important, she was preparing to scold St. George. The previous night he had promised that she would either receive some good news or her mind would be set at rest and her ordeal would come to an end. 2. Elishva's neighbor Umm Salim believed strongly, unlike many others, that Elishva had special powers and that God's hand was on her shoulder wherever she was. She could cite numerous incidents as evidence. Although sometimes she might criticize or think ill of the old woman, she quickly went back to respecting and honoring her. When Elishva came to visit and they sat with some of their neighbors in the shade in Umm Salim's old courtyard, Umm Salim spread out for her a woven mat, placed cushions to the right and left of her, and poured her tea. Sometimes she might exaggerate and say openly in Elishva's presence that if it weren't for those inhabitants who had baraka, spiritual power, the neighborhood would be doomed and swallowed up by the earth on God's orders. But this belief of Umm Salim's was really like the smoke she blew from her shisha pipe during those afternoon chats. It came out in billows, then coiled into sinuous white clouds that vanished into the air, never to travel outside the courtyard. Many thought of Elishva as just a demented old woman with amnesia, the proof being that she couldn't remember the names of men, even those she had known for half a century. Sometimes she looked at them in a daze, as though they had sprung up in the neighborhood out of nowhere. Umm Salim and some of the other kind-hearted neighbors were distraught when Elishva started to tell bizarre stories about things that had happened to her, stories that no reasonable person would believe. Others scoffed, saying that Umm Salim and the other women were just sad that one of their number had crossed over to the dark and desolate shore beyond, meaning the group as a whole was headed in the same direction. 3. Two people were sure Elishva didn't have special powers, or anything, and was just a crazy old woman. The first was Faraj, the realtor, owner of the Rasul Realty office on the main commercial street in Batawin. The second was Hadi, the junk dealer, who lived in a makeshift dwelling attached to Elishva's house. Over the past few years, Faraj had tried repeatedly to persuade Elishva to sell her old house, but Elishva just flatly refused, without explanation. Faraj couldn't understand why an old woman like her would want to live alone in a 7-room house with only a cat. Why, he wondered, didn't she sell it and move to a smaller house with more air and light and use the extra money to live the rest of her life in comfort? Faraj never got a good answer. As for Hadi, her neighbor, he was a scruffy, unfriendly man in his 50s who always smelled of alcohol. He had asked Elishva to sell him the antiques that filled her house. 2 large wall clocks, teak tables of various sizes, carpets and furnishings, and plaster and ivory statues of the Virgin Mary and the infant Jesus. There were more than 20 of these statues spread around the house, as well as many other things that Hadi hadn't had time to inspect. Of these antiques, some of which dated back to the 1940s, Hadi had asked Elishva, "Why don't you sell them? Save yourself the trouble of dusting," his eyes popping out of his head at the sight of them all. But the old woman just walked him to the front door and sent him out into the street, closing the door behind him. That was the only time Hadi had seen the inside of her house, and the impression it left him with was of a strange museum. The two men didn't abandon their efforts, but because the junk dealer usually wasn't presentable, Elishva's neighbors were not sympathetic to him. Faraj the realtor tried several times to encourage Elishva's neighbors to win her over to his proposal. Some even accused Veronica Munib, the Armenian neighbor, of taking a bribe from Faraj to persuade Elishva to move in with Salim and her husband. Faraj never lost hope. Hadi, on the other hand, constantly pestered Elishva until he eventually lost interest and just threw hostile glances her way whenever she passed him on the street. Elishva not only rejected the offers from these two men, she also reserved a special hatred for them, consigning them to everlasting hell. In their faces she saw two greedy people with tainted souls, like cheap carpets with permanent ink stains. Abu Zeydun the barber could be added to the list of people Elishva hated and cursed. Elishva had lost Daniel because of him. He was the Ba'athist who had taken her son by the collar and dragged him off into the unknown. But Abu Zeydun had been out of sight for many years. Elishva no longer ran into him, and no one talked about him in front of her. Since leaving the Ba'ath party, he had been preoccupied with his many ailments and had no time for anything that happened in the neighborhood. 4. Faraj was at home when the massive explosion went off in Tehran Square. 3 hours later, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, he opened his realty office and noticed cracks in the large front window. He cursed his bad luck, though he had noticed the shattered windows of many other shops in the area. In fact, he could see Abu Anmar, owner of the Oruba Hotel across the street, standing bewildered on the sidewalk in his dishdasha amid shards of glass from his old hotel's upper windows. Faraj could see that Abu Anmar was shocked, but he didn't care. He had no great affection for him. They were polar opposites, even undeclared rivals. Abu Anmar, like many of the hotel owners in Batawin, made his living off workers and students and people who came to Baghdad from the provinces to visit hospitals or clinics or to go shopping. Over the past decade, with the departure of many of the Egyptian and Sudanese migrant workers, hotels had become dependent on a few customers who lived in them almost permanently. Drivers on long-distance bus routes, students who didn't like the college dorms, and people who worked in the restaurants in Bab al-Sharqi and Saadun Street, in the factories that made shoes and other things, and in the harsh flea market. But most of these people disappeared after April 2003, and now many of the hotels were nearly empty. To make matters worse, Faraj had appeared on the scene trying to win over customers who might otherwise have gone to Abu Anmar's hotel or one of the others in the area. Faraj had taken advantage of the chaos and lawlessness in the city to get his hands on several houses of unknown ownership. He turned these into cheap boarding houses, renting the rooms to workers from the provinces or to families displaced from nearby areas for sectarian reasons or because of old vendettas that had come back into effect with the fall of the regime. Abu Anmar could only grumble and complain. He had moved to Baghdad from the south in the 1970s, and had no relatives or friends in the capital to help him. In the past, he had relied on the power of the regime. Faraj, on the other hand, had many relatives and acquaintances, and when the regime fell, they were the means by which he imposed authority, winning everyone's respect and legalizing his appropriation of the abandoned houses, even though everyone knew he didn't have the papers to prove he owned them or had ever rented them from the government. Faraj could use his growing power against Elishva. He had seen her house from the inside only twice, but had fallen in love with it immediately. It had probably been built by Jews, since it was in the style favored by the Iraqi Jews, an inner courtyard surrounded by several rooms on two floors, with a basement under one of the rooms that opened onto the street. There were fluted wooden columns supporting the arcade on the upper floor. With the metal railings inlaid with wood, they created a unique aesthetic effect. The house also had double-leaf wooden doors with metal bolts and locks, and wooden windows reinforced with metal bars and glazed with stained glass. The courtyard was paved with fine brickwork, and the rooms with small black-and-white tiles like a chessboard. The courtyard was open to the sky and had once been covered with a white cloth that was removed during the summer, but the cloth was no longer there. The house was not as it once had been, but it was sturdy and had suffered little water damage, unlike similar houses on the street. The basement had been filled in at some point, but that didn't matter. The main drawback for Farage was that one of the rooms on the upper floor had completely collapsed, with many of the bricks having fallen beyond the wall shared with the house next door, the total ruin inhabited by Hadi the junk dealer. The bathroom on the upper floor was also in ruins. Farage would need to spend some money on repairs and renovations, but it would be worth it. Farage thought it would take only half an hour to evict a defenseless old Christian woman, but a voice in his head warned him that he risked breaking the law and offending people, so it might be better to first gauge people's feelings about the old woman. The best thing would be to wait till she died, and then no one but he would dare to take over the house, since everyone knew how attached he was to it and acknowledged him as its future owner, however long Elishva lived.
"Look on the bright side!"
Farage shouted to Abu Anmar, who was wringing his hands in dismay at the damage to his property. Abu Anmar raised his arms to the heavens in solidarity with Farage's optimism, or maybe he was saying, "May God take you," to the greedy realtor whom fate had taunted him with all day long. 5. Elishva shoved her cat off the sofa and brushed away the loose cat hairs. She couldn't actually see any hairs, but she knew from stroking the cat that its hair was falling out all over the place. She could overlook the hair unless it was in her special spot on the sofa, facing the large picture of St. George the Martyr that hung between smaller gray pictures of her son and her husband, framed in carved wood. There were two other pictures of the same size, one of the Last Supper, and the other of Christ being taken down from the cross, and three miniatures copied from medieval icons, drawn in thick ink and faded colors, depicting various saints, some of whose names she didn't know because it was her husband who had put them up many years ago. They were still as they were originally hung, some in the parlor, some in her bedroom, some in Daniel's room, which was closed, and some in the other abandoned rooms. Almost every evening she sat there to resume her sterile conversation with the saint with the angelic face. The saint wasn't in ecclesiastical dress. He was wearing thick, shiny plates of armor that covered his body, and a plumed helmet, with his wavy blonde hair peeking out from under the helmet. He was holding a long, pointed lance and sitting on a muscular white horse that had reared up to avoid the jaws of a hideous dragon encroaching from the corner of the picture, intent on swallowing the horse, the saint, and all his military accoutrements. Elishva ignored the extravagant details. She put on the thick glasses that hung from a cord around her neck and looked at the calm, angelic face that betrayed no emotion. He wasn't angry or desperate or dreamy or happy. He was just doing his job out of devotion to God. Elishva found no comfort in abstract speculation. She treated her patron saint as one of her relatives, a member of a family that had been torn apart and dispersed. He was the only person she had left, apart from Nabu the cat and the specter of her son Daniel, who was bound to return one day. To others, she lived alone. But she believed she lived with three beings, or three ghosts, with so much power and presence that she didn't feel lonely. She was angry because her patron saint hadn't fulfilled any of the three promises she had extracted from him after countless nights of pleading, begging, and weeping. She didn't have much time left on this earth, and she wanted a sign from the Lord about Daniel, whether he was alive and would return, or where his real grave or his remains were. She wanted to challenge her patron saint on the promises he had given her, but she waited for night to fall, because during the day the picture was just a picture, inanimate and completely still. But at night, a portal opened between her world and the other world, and the Lord came down, embodied in the image of the saint, to talk through him to Elishva, the poor sheep who had been abandoned by the rest of the flock and had almost fallen into the abyss of faithless perdition. That night, by the light of the oil lamp, Elishva could see the ripples in the old picture behind the murky glass. But she could see also the saint's eyes, and his soft, handsome face. Nabu meowed irritably as he left the room. The saint's long arm was still holding the lance, but now his eyes were on Elishva. "You're too impatient, Elishva," he said. "I told you the Lord will bring you peace of mind, or put an end to your torment, or you will hear news that will bring you joy. But no one can make the Lord act at a certain time." Elishva argued with the saint for half an hour, until his beautiful face reverted to its normal state, his dreamy gaze stiff and immobile, a sign that he had grown tired of this sterile discussion. Before going to bed, she said her usual prayers in front of the large wooden cross in her bedroom and checked that Nabu was asleep in the corner on a small tigerskin rug. The next day, after having breakfast and washing the dishes, she was surprised to hear the annoying roar of American Apache helicopters flying overhead. She saw her son Daniel, or imagined she did. There was Danny, as she had always called him when he was young. At last, her patron saint's prophecy had come true. She called him, and he came over to her. "Come, my son. Come, Danny." Chapter 2. The Liar. 1. To make the stories he told more interesting, Hadi was careful to include realistic details. He remembered all the details of the things that happened to him and included them every time he recounted his experiences. One day he was in Aziz the Egyptian's coffee shop, sitting on the bench in the corner by the front window and stroking his mustache and his forked beard. He ground the small spoon nervously into the bottom of the teacup and took two sips of tea before starting to tell his story again, this time for the benefit of some patrons whom Aziz had encouraged to listen to Hadi. The guests were a slim, blonde German journalist with thin lips and thick glasses perched on her small nose, her young Iraqi translator, a Palestinian photographer, and a swarthy young journalist named Mahmoud Al-Sawadi, who came from the town of Amara in southern Iraq and was living in Abu Anmar's Uruba Hotel. The German journalist was making a documentary about Baghdad journalists and was accompanying Mahmoud Al-Sawadi on a normal working day. She hadn't planned to listen to a long, complicated story told by a junk dealer with bulging eyes who reeked of alcohol and whose tattered clothes were dotted with cigarette burns. She was taking a risk by being out on the streets of Baghdad in such a conspicuous way, so she hadn't turned on her camera, and was just listening as she drank her tea. Every now and then she turned to her Iraqi translator, who gave her a lengthy explanation of what Hadi was saying. Hadi was rambling. It was a warm spring day, and the German journalist would have preferred to spend the rest of it outside. And at some point, she had to get back to the press center at the Sheraton Hotel to transcribe the tapes she had recorded with Mahmoud Al-Sawadi. "That guy's recounting the plot of a movie," she said to Mahmoud as he walked her out of the coffee shop. "He's stolen his story from a Robert De Niro film. Yes, it looks like he watches lots of movies. He's well known in the area." "Then he should have gone to Hollywood," she said with a laugh as she got into the translator's car. 2. Hadi wasn't bothered. Some people walk out in the middle of movies. It's quite normal.
"Where did we leave off?"
asked Hadi, as Mahmoud returned and sat on the bench opposite him. Aziz stood, holding the empty teacups and smiling broadly, waiting for Hadi to resume his story.
"We'd got into the explosion," said Aziz. "The first one or the second?" asked Hadi.
"The first one, in Tehran Square," said Mahmoud, waiting for Hadi to contradict himself by changing some of the details. That was the only reason Mahmoud was willing to listen to the story for the second or third time, to see if Hadi would contradict himself. The explosion was horrific, and here Hadi looked to Aziz for confirmation. Hadi had run out of the coffee shop. He had been eating some of the beans that Ali Al-Sayed made in the shop next door, and that Hadi ate for breakfast every morning. On his way out of the shop, he collided with people running from the explosion. The smell suddenly hit his nostrils. The smoke, the burning of plastic and seat cushions, the roasting of human flesh. You wouldn't have smelled anything like it in your life,
and would never forget it. The sky was cloudy and threatening a downpour. The workers were lined up in large numbers across from the grand white Armenian church with the cross-topped towers in the shape of octagonal pyramids. Smoking, chatting, drinking tea, eating cake from the street vendors on the wide sidewalk, or pickled turnips, or beans from the nearby carts. They waited for vehicles looking for day laborers for building or demolition work. Along the same curb, there were buses calling for passengers going to Karada or to the University of Technology. And at the opposite curb, it was much the same. Cars interspersed with stalls selling cigarettes, candy, underwear, and many other things. A gray four-wheel drive stopped, and most of the workers sitting on the curb stood up. When some of them approached, the vehicle exploded in a ball of fire. No one saw it coming. It all happened in a fraction of a second. The people who weren't injured, because they were too far away, or screened by other people's bodies, or behind parked cars, or because they were coming down the side lanes and hadn't reached the main street when the explosion went off, all these people and others, like those in the offices next to the Armenian church and some long-distance taxi drivers, witnessed the explosion as it engulfed the vehicles and the bodies of the people around them. It cut electricity wires and killed birds. Windows were shattered and doors blown in. Cracks appeared in the walls of the nearby houses, and some old ceilings collapsed. There was unseen damage, too, all inflicted in a single moment. Hadi was watching the scene after the commotion had died down and the big cloud of smoke had lifted. Trails of black smoke continued to rise from the cars, and flames licked small burning objects scattered on the pavement. The police came quickly and set up a cordon. Injured people were groaning, and bodies were lying in heaps on the asphalt, covered in blood and singed black by the heat. Hadi said that when he reached the scene, he stood at the corner by the hardware stores and calmly watched. As he recounted the story, Hadi lit a cigarette and started to smoke, as if trying to get rid of the smell of the explosion. He liked the idea of appearing on the scene as a kind of disinterested villain, and he waited to see from the faces of those who were listening whether they were similarly impressed. Ambulances came to pick up the dead and injured, then fire engines to douse the cars, and tow trucks to drag them off to an unknown destination. Water hoses washed away the blood and ashes. Hadi watched the scene with eagle eyes, looking for something in particular amid this binge of death and devastation. Once he was sure he had seen it, he threw his cigarette to the ground and rushed to grab it before a powerful jet of water could blast it down the storm drain. He wrapped it in his canvas sack, folded the sack under his arm, and left the scene. 3. Hadi got home before the downpour began. He crossed the loose paving stones of the courtyard, went to his room, and put the folded canvas sack down on his bed. He had been breathing so heavily he could hear a whistling in his nose and a wheezing in his chest. He reached for the folded canvas sack, then changed his mind and decided to wait. He preferred to listen to the sound of the raindrops, which had started tentatively and then pattered steadily. Within moments, the rain was pelting down, flushing the courtyard, the streets, Tayaran Square, and what remained of all the day's horrors. Calling Hadi's place a house would be an exaggeration. Many people knew it well, especially Aziz the Egyptian before he got married and gave up the dissolute lifestyle. He and Hadi used to sit around Hadi's table and drink till late, or Aziz might find Hadi with one or two of the prostitutes from Lane 5. It was always fun with Hadi, because he didn't deny himself when it came to pleasure. Hadi's house wasn't really his, and wasn't really a house. Most of what was in it was falling apart. There was only one room right at the back. It had holes in the roof, and Hadi and a colleague named Nahem Abdaki had made it their base 3 years earlier. Hadi and Nahem had been known in the area for years. They drove a horse-drawn cart around, buying household junk, pots and pans, and appliances that didn't work. Mornings, they'd stop by Aziz's coffee shop for breakfast and tea, before setting out on a grand tour of Batawin and the Abu Nawas neighborhood on the other side of Saadun Street. Then they would head off in Nahim's cart to other parts of the city, as far south as Karada, where they disappeared into the back streets. After the American invasion, everyone noticed amid the chaos that Hadi and Nahem were rebuilding what they called the Jewish Ruin, although nothing Jewish was ever seen there. No candelabra, no Stars of David, or Hebrew inscriptions. Hadi rebuilt the ruin's outer wall with whatever was lying around, and installed the big wooden door that had been hidden under dirt and piles of bricks. He and Nahem removed the stones from the courtyard, restored the ruin's only good room, and left the half-walls and the collapsing ceilings of the other rooms as they were. The room above Hadi's had one wall standing with a window. The wall was in danger of collapsing and burying alive anyone who happened to be in the courtyard, but the wall never did fall over. The locals eventually realized that Hadi and his friend had become part of the neighborhood. Even Faraj the realtor, who was notorious for appropriating houses that had been abandoned by their owners, showed no interest in what the junk dealer had claimed for his use. To Faraj, the place remained the Jewish ruin, as it always had been. Where had these two men come from? No one gave much thought to the question, because the area had plenty of outsiders who had moved in on top of each other over many decades. No one could claim to be an original inhabitant. A year or two later, Nahem got married, rented a house in Bataween, and moved out of Hadi's place, although he and Hadi still worked together with the horse and cart. Nahem was younger than Hadi, in his mid to late 30s, and they seemed like father and son, although they didn't look like each other. Nahem had big ears on a small head, with hair that was full and long and straight, but like coarse wire, and thick eyebrows that almost converged. Hadi used to joke that even if Nahem lived to be 120, he would never lose his hair. Hadi was over 50, though it was hard to judge his age. He was always disheveled, with an untrimmed forked beard, a body that was wiry but hard and energetic, and a bony face with sunken cheeks. Hadi called his partner Old Misery. Unlike Hadi, Nahem didn't smoke or drink, was fastidious about religious matters, and didn't touch a woman till his wedding day. Because of his religious scruples, he was the one who baptized the house when they moved in, putting up on the wall in the main room a large framed copy of the throne verse of the Quran. He glued it to the wall to make sure it would be hard to remove, at least until it fell apart. Hadi had no regard for religion, but he didn't want to seem antagonistic, so he let it slide that the verse was the first thing he saw every day. Nahem didn't live long enough to find out whether his head of hair would last as Hadi always predicted. By the time Hadi sat in Aziz's coffee shop with Mahmud al-Sawadi and some old men telling more of his story, Nahem had already been dead for several months, from a car bomb that had exploded in front of the office of a religious party in Karada, killing also some other passers-by and Nahem's horse. It had been hard to separate Nahem's flesh from that of the horse. The shock of Nahem's death changed Hadi. He became aggressive. He swore and cursed and threw stones after the American Hummers or the vehicles of the police and the National Guard. He got into arguments with anyone who mentioned Nahem and what had happened to him. He kept to himself for a while, and then went back to his old self, laughing and telling extraordinary stories. But now he seemed to have two faces, or two masks. As soon as he was alone, he was gloomy and despondent in a way he hadn't been before. He also started drinking during the day, and always had quarters of arak or whiskey in his pocket and the smell of alcohol on his breath. He grew dirtier, let his beard grow longer, and rarely washed his clothes. Nahem Abdaki was never mentioned again, lest Hadi throw a tantrum and start shouting obscenities. So Mahmud al-Sawadi didn't hear about Nahem till later in the version of the story told by Aziz the Egyptian. 4.
"Where did we leave off?" asked Hadi after relieving himself in the toilets next to the coffee shop.
"At the part about the big nose in the canvas sack," Mahmud al-Sawadi replied wearily.
"Oh, yes, the nose."
Hadi was zipping up his fly as he came toward the bench by the front window of the coffee shop. He sat down to resume his story, and Mahmud, who was hoping to catch him out, was disappointed to find he hadn't changed any of the details. Before going to the bathroom, he had paused at the point in the story when the rain stopped and he went out to the courtyard with the canvas sack. Looking up at the sky, he saw the clouds breaking up like wisps of cotton, as if all at once they'd released their water and were now departing. Some of the second-hand furniture was sitting in rainwater, which would damage it, but Hadi wasn't thinking about that. He went to the shed, which he had assembled out of scraps of furniture, iron bars, and sections of kitchen units he had leaned up against the piece of wall that still remained and squatted down at one end. The rest of the shed was dominated by a massive corpse, the body of a naked man, with viscous liquids, light and color, oozing from parts of it. There was only a little blood, some small dried patches on the arms and legs, and some grazes and bruises around the shoulders and neck. It was hard to say what color the skin was. It didn't have a uniform color. Hadi moved farther into the narrow space around the body and sat down close to the head. The area where the nose should have been was badly disfigured, as if a wild animal had bitten a chunk out of it. Hadi opened the canvas sack and took out the thing. In recent days, he had spent hours looking for one like it, yet he was still uneasy handling it. It was a fresh nose, still coated in congealed dark red blood. His hand trembling, he positioned it in the black hole in the corpse's face. It was a perfect fit, as if the corpse had its own nose back. Hadi withdrew his hand, wiped his fingers on his clothes, and looked at the face with some dissatisfaction. But his task was now finished. Actually, it wasn't quite finished. He had to sew the nose in place. The nose was all the corpse needed to be complete, so now Hadi was finishing the job. It was a horrible job, one he had done without anyone's help, and somehow it didn't seem to make any sense despite all the arguments he used when trying to explain himself to his listeners.
I wanted to hand him over to the forensics department, because it was a complete corpse that had been left in the streets like trash. It's a human being, guys, a person, he told them. But it wasn't a complete corpse. You made it complete, someone objected. I made it complete, so it wouldn't be treated as trash, so it would be respected like other dead people and given a proper burial, Hadi explained. What happened next? To me? Or the what's-its-name? To both of you.
Hadi's listeners were completely wrapped up in the story. New listeners risked missing the pleasures of the story if they insisted on challenging it right from the start. The logical objections were usually left to the end, and no one interfered with the way the story was told or with the subplots Hadi went into. Hadi had an appointment with a man in Karada. For several days he hadn't bought or sold anything, and his money was starting to run out. He had been pursuing the man for a while because there could be some money in it for him. He was another old person living alone in his own house, very much like Elishva, but this old one had a girlfriend in Russia who had persuaded him to sell his house and furniture and to emigrate so they could spend their retirement together. No problem with that. May they live happily ever after. But whenever Hadi thought he and the old man had come to an agreement, the man would panic about losing his furniture, especially his chandeliers, reading lamps, and old-fashioned valve radios. He would cling to them as if he would drown without them. Hadi didn't want to put pressure on him or frighten him off, so he went away and then came back later to find him all smiles and enthusiastic about sealing a deal. Hadi washed his hands after handling the corpse. He changed into clean clothes and went out to meet the reluctant old man, worried that someone else might convince him to sell his valuable furniture or might lease the house furnished, allowing the old man to retain ownership and collect rent, while the tenant harbored hopes of assuming ownership when he died. The man's house wasn't far. Hadi could board the bus and be there in 5 minutes. When there was traffic, he would make the trip on foot, along the way collecting empty soda and beer cans in a large canvas sack. He could sell them later to the peddlers who specialized in such things, or save them in sacks at home, and then hire a pickup to take them to the aluminum recycling plant in Hafez al-Kadi near Rashid Street.
And the corpse, for God's sake, what happened to that? Hang on a while.
Hadi reached the man's house and knocked on the door, but no one came to open it. Perhaps the man was asleep or out. Perhaps he was now dead. His time had come before he could see his Russian girlfriend again and touch her thin, wrinkled hands. Hadi kept knocking till he attracted the attention of the neighbors. Then he turned back to Saadun Street and went to a restaurant near the Rama Hospital. He ate a kebab sandwich and ordered two kebab skewers to take home with him. The clouds had completely cleared, but the wind blew in unpredictable gusts from various directions. The cigarette vendor's umbrella had toppled over, the block of cement in the large tin can it was in, preventing it from flying away. Buffeted by the wind, the pedestrians were having a hard time walking. Some looked as though a hidden hand was slapping them or pushing them along from behind. People sitting outside coffee shops soon went inside, and drivers with their car windows partly open wound them firmly closed. The newspaper and magazine vendors dispersed, and the people who sold cigarettes and sweets at traffic lights put their goods into their shoulder bags so they wouldn't blow away. People wearing hats pressed them down hard to keep them from flying away. At the Sadir Novotel Hotel, overlooking Andalus Square, the palm trees swayed, and the guard in the forecourt fastened his military jacket tight. He didn't have to stand in the open air, but his wooden sentry box didn't protect him from either the cold or the heat. If he had been a soldier or a policeman in one of the units posted throughout the streets of Baghdad, he would have lit a fire in an open oil drum to keep himself warm, covering his clothes in soot, but the hotel management had banned such things.
"And now is going on about the hotel guard. Be patient, man. He's coming to your part of the story."
Hadi finished off his kebab, drank a can of Pepsi, and then crushed it with his hand and threw it into the canvas sack beside him. He didn't want to go out in the high wind, so he passed the time by picking through the restaurant's trash and removing all the soda cans. When the storm had died down, he went outside to find that the sun had disappeared, and the sky had turned gray and was growing darker by the minute. He couldn't think straight. Then he remembered the corpse he had left at home, and he felt dizzy. Without thinking, he walked toward the Andalus Square intersection. It was an extraordinary day. On the restaurant's television, he had heard there had been explosions during the day in Kademiya, Sadr City, the Mansour district, and Bab al-Sharqi. There was footage of the injured in the Kindi hospital, and images of Tehran Square as the fire brigade hosed it down. Hadi expected to see himself on TV, on the corner by the hardware stores, smoking calmly like a criminal observing the aftermath of his crime. A government spokesman appeared, answering journalists' questions with a smile. He assured them that the government had thwarted the terrorists because, according to intelligence, Al-Qaeda and remnants of the old regime had planned 100 car bombings, but the coalition forces and the Iraqi security services had foiled all but 15 of them. The fat restaurant owner blew a long, rumbling raspberry as he listened to what the government spokesman said. There had in fact been 16 explosions, but the last one wasn't mentioned by the spokesman because he'd gone home by the time it happened. Hadi was walking along with the sack of cans slung over his shoulder. When he reached the Sadir Novotel, he usually crossed to the other side of the road so the guards didn't shout at him. But this time he forgot, preoccupied as he was with the thought of the corpse in his shed at home. What was he going to do? He had accomplished the task he had set himself. Should he hire a car to take the body to the forensics department? Should he take it out one night and leave it in some square, or on the street, and let the police come and finish the job? As he was passing in front of the large metal gate of the hotel garage, he realized he was in a quandary. The only good solution was to go home, take the corpse apart, and restore it to what it had been, just disconnected body parts. Then he should scatter the parts throughout the streets where he had found them. Meanwhile, shivering from the cold, the guard considered stretching his legs. He stepped out of the sentry box toward the gate, then grabbed onto the cold bars of the gate and watched as the creature with his suspicious bag walked past. He didn't think it necessary to warn him to move off.
"And you saw all this yourself?"
Hadi prompted Mahmud.
"Yes, I was standing with some friends on the other side of the street when I saw a garbage truck heading toward the hotel gate." "You saw it? There you are. So I didn't make any of it up. This guy's a witness."
When he was 20 yards past the gate, Hadi saw the garbage truck race past him toward the gate, almost knocking him over. A few moments later, it exploded. Hadi, together with his sack and his dinner, was lifted off the ground. With the dust and dirt and blast of the explosion, he sailed through the air, turned a somersault, and landed hard on the asphalt. Maybe a minute passed before he realized what had happened. He saw some young people running in his direction. The journalist Mahmoud Al-Sawadi was among them and helped Hadi get up. Dust and smoke were everywhere. Terrified, Hadi started walking away. The people who had helped him shouted after him, thinking maybe he was injured and couldn't feel it. But he started running. He was clearly in a state of shock. Darkness had fallen. In the distance, Hadi could hear police cars, ambulances, and fire engines. The cloud of dust and smoke dispersed into a thin fog that lit up in the headlights of the vehicles. Mahmoud and the other witnesses, afraid and confused, made their way down the street, crunching underfoot the unseen shards of glass, small pieces of metal, and other debris from the explosion. 5. Hadi walked with great effort. He had excruciating pains in his arms and his pelvis, and cuts on his forehead and cheekbone from falling on the asphalt. He was hobbling along, dragging his feet with difficulty. Had he been thinking clearly, he might have taken a taxi to Bab al-Sharqi. In fact, he wasn't thinking about anything at all. It was as if someone had pressed a button and he'd started walking, nothing more. And maybe when he ran out of energy, he would collapse. Hadi kept saying he wouldn't die. He had survived several other explosions. What mattered most to him was that his body hadn't been hit by shrapnel. All his injuries were from hitting the ground, and they were minor. Upon arriving home, without his canvas sack or the dinner he'd bought from the restaurant, he dropped these at the scene of the explosion. He pushed open the heavy wooden door, but forgot to close it behind him. When he looked in the distance at the door to his room, he felt it was much farther than usual. He walked across the courtyard's broken paving stones, frightened he might fall and die or faint. He wanted to reach his bed. When he got to his room, he threw himself on the mattress and quickly fell into a deep sleep, or perhaps it was a coma that he had managed to postpone. The next day, Hadi woke to the sound of the radio news bulletin. It might have been coming from the neighbor's house behind his, or maybe Salim was sitting on the stoop across from his front door, hugging the radio and watching the people coming and going, as she sometimes did. When Hadi lifted his head, he saw that the pillow was covered with saliva and spots of dried blood. At first he thought he must have been very drunk, but then he remembered the explosion, and then the body in the shed. It would be more decomposed today. Maybe people walking past the house would be able to smell it. Hadi got up and could tell from the light that it was close to midday. He washed his face. The pain was intense as he moved his limbs. When he turned around, he saw what effect the storm had had on the courtyard during his absence. Some of the old kitchen and office units had been overturned. Pieces of the wooden roofing had been blown away. The ceiling was gone. When he looked closer, he discovered that many other things had disappeared. The corpse, too, was gone. He turned everything upside down, then went back to his room and looked in there. His heart was beating faster and faster, and he forgot about the pains that racked his bones. Where on earth had the corpse gone? He stopped in the middle of the courtyard, afraid and confused. He looked up at the clear blue sky, then at the high walls of the neighbors' houses, then at the low roof that was left over from the room in Elishva's house that had collapsed. A mangy old cat had its gaze fixed on him. It gave a deep meow. Then it turned slowly and disappeared behind the crumbling wall.
And then?
That's it. That's the end.
What do you mean, that's it? So where did the corpse go, Hadi?
I don't know.
That's not a nice story, Hadi. Tell us another one.
If you don't believe it, that's your choice.
Okay, I'm off now.
The T's are on you.
Chapter 3. A Lost Soul. 1. Hasib Mohammed Jafar was 21 years old, dark, slim, and married to Dua Jabbar. He lived with Dua and their baby daughter Zahra in Sector 44 in Sadr City, in a room in the house of his large family. Hasib, who had been working for 7 months as a guard at the Sadir Novotel Hotel, was killed in an explosion caused by a Sudanese suicide bomber driving a dynamite-laden garbage truck stolen from the Baghdad municipality. The bomber was planning to crash through the hotel's outer gate, drive the truck into the hotel lobby, and detonate the explosives, bringing down the whole building. He failed because the guard bravely fired several rounds at the driver, causing him to detonate the explosives early. The guard's belongings were handed back to his family. His civilian clothes, a new pair of socks, a bottle of cologne, and the first volume of Al-Sayyab's collected poems. In the coffin they put his burned black shoes, his shredded blood-stained clothes, and small charred parts of his body. There was little left of Hasib Muhammad Jafar. The coffin that was taken to the cemetery in Najaf was more of a token. Hasib's young wife wrapped her arms around it, wept bitterly, and wailed at length. Hasib's mother, sisters and brothers, and neighbors did the same, and his stunned little daughter was passed from arm to arm whenever the person holding her was overwhelmed by grief. Exhausted, every member of the family went to sleep, dreaming of Hasib walking home with a cloth bag over his shoulder. They all dreamed something about Hasib. Parts of one dream made up for parts missing in another. A little dream filled a gap in a big one, and the threads stitched together to recreate a dream body for Hasib, to go with his soul, which was still hovering over all their heads and seeking the rest it could not find. Where was the body to which it should return, in order to take its place among those who live in a state of limbo? 2. When Hasib saw the garbage truck, many possible explanations flooded his mind. It was just a garbage truck. The driver had made a mistake. He had lost control and veered off toward the hotel gate. There had been a traffic accident, and the driver had sped off and was unintentionally heading for the gate. No, it was a suicide bomber.
Stop! Stop!
One shot, then another. He didn't mean to kill the driver. He wouldn't dare kill anyone. But this was his duty. He was well aware of the strict orders about protecting the hotel. There were security companies and important people and maybe Americans in it. He had a license to kill, as they say. The thoughts raced through his head in fractions of a second as his fingers squeezed the trigger, maybe even before he had decided on the best course of action. The truck blew up, and Hasib was aware of himself observing the explosion, but not from his position between the wooden sentry box and the big hotel's outer gate. He was looking at the flames, the smoke, and the flying pieces of metal from high in the air. He felt a strange calm. He saw a man with a white canvas sack hurtling through the air and landing quite a distance from the explosion. He saw pieces of glass from the hotel windows and the lobby facade flying toward the hotel forecourt. A few moments later, the cloud of smoke settled, and half an hour passed before the ambulances and fire trucks arrived. He watched darkness descend on the city. He saw the distant lights of buildings, houses, and vehicles. He saw some of the nearby flyovers. He saw the floodlights of the sports stadium and some minarets in the distance covered with bright lights. He could see the river, too, deep and black in the darkness. He wanted to touch it. He had never touched the river. He had lived all his life far from it. He had driven over it, seen it from a distance, and seen pictures of it on television. But he had never felt the coldness of the water or tasted it. He saw a man in a white vest and white shorts floating face up in it. What bliss! He must be looking at the stars, clear in the night sky. He was drifting slowly with the current. Hasib moved toward him and looked into his face.
"Why are you looking at me, my son?" the man said. "Go and find out what happened to your body. Don't stay here."
He saw another dead body, floating face down in the water. It didn't say anything. It just floated slowly, in silence. 3. Hasib went back to the hotel gate and looked at the large hole the suicide bomber had made with his truck bomb. He recognized his burned boots, but couldn't find his body. He looked in all the streets and in Firdaus Square, then went to Tahrir Square and saw birds perched on the bronze figures that make up the Liberty Monument. Then it occurred to him to go to the cemetery. There in the valley,